This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Ricky Ducournay with Joanna Scott, recorded in Santa Fe, March 9, 2005. Ricky Ducournay, author of 6 novels to date, writes sensuous, imaginative, complicated fables, mixing reality and exotic dreams. In this program, she reads from her novel, The Fan Maker's Inquisition, before joining in conversation with fiction writer Joanna Scott.
Welcome to the Lannan Readings and Conversations. I'm Joanna Scott. It is wonderful to be in this beautiful town of Santa Fe. I love it. Everybody I've talked to seems to come here and fall in love with the town. Well, I have too, and I'm still weeping over the chili pepper sauce I tried today, so if you'll excuse me. I'm going to begin with a bit of rather vague geometry and ask you to picture a large empty circle in a vast open space. Now picture a crowd of different shapes inside the circle. From a distance, the outline of the circle gives the crowd of shapes a common identity. We may not be able to tell much about the shapes, but we know that they share one thing. They are inside the circle. Now picture the space outside the circle's boundary. Let's say that space is populated with various shapes. Because they are outside the crowded center, the shapes are easier to see individually, but harder to define. The circle of literature is crowded with diverse works. Inside the circle, writing is assumed to have at least one common characteristic. It shares the same boundary. It's a boundary that can shrink or expand, but it continues to provide a defining contrast. Imagination can't really go wild inside the circle. In particular, a work of fiction is recognizable as fiction because the unreal events are dependably plausible. We can trust that whatever happens in a story or novel could happen, even if it has never happened and never will happen. But it's the outer space of literature we're going to explore tonight. Without the defining boundary, the world we think we know can look shockingly strange, and the unreal products of the imagination, the stuff of dreams, magic, games, reverie, mythology, can seem shockingly plausible. How do we approach a book if it mixes up dreams and reality? Confusion is a danger in the boundless space outside the circle, and for this reason alone, too many readers tend to focus their attention inside the circle. But we should remember that the outer space of fiction is a vibrant place. This is where we'll find Gulliver and Tristram Shandy and Lewis Carroll's Alice. This is where we'll find Virginia Woolf's Orlando, Gertrude Stein's Gertrude Stein and Kafka's K. This is where we'll find Calvino's Invisible Cities, Beckett's Fizzles and Borges' Labyrinths. And this is where we'll find Ricky Ducournay, who occupies a space outside the circle with her generous, delicate, intoxicating imagination. A book is a place to think, Ricky writes in a recent essay. The work of the writer, she suggests, is to move beyond the simple definitions or descriptions of things. She reminds us that we need to be attentive and fearless, above all very curious, and all at the same time. Ricky's books are fueled by fearless curiosity, focused in a relentless pursuit of mystery. The linguistic expressions are more than playful, they are groundbreaking. As she said in a recent interview, with each new book, she hopes to find a new language, new ways of thinking about determinism, subverting dogmatic thinking, received ideas. Her primary concern is with the fundamental problems of intellectual freedom. Every work that springs from Ricky Ducournay's imagination sheds new light on what she has described as the mysteries of matter. Ricky once wrote that her ambition, which she insists has never been realized, was to paint the museum scenery behind walruses and saber-toothed tigers. Even now, she says, she longs for her own poetic territory, which would include a keeping garden for insects, an extensive zoological library, color plates intact, a wonder room, and a jade cabinet, which would ideally contain a chimera of mutton-fat jade. It's clear from reading Ricky's work that she has, in fact, realized her ambition. In her meditations, her stories, her novels, her art, she has made a garden as intricate and surprising as the wonderland where Alice wanders. She has given readers access to the mind's expansive potential. In an essay from her collection, The Monstrous and the Marvelous, Ricky writes, I'm always looking for spaces which evoke a sensation of strangeness, one that stimulates the eye, the imagining mind, and the body all at once. In her fiction, she finds and illuminates these spaces. It is a space where the character Nicholas in the Fountains of Neptune can exclaim, the most powerful thing in my life has been my own bewilderment. It is a space where a character named Memory in Ricky's novel, The Jade Cabinet, can say in an aside, all things in this world are precarious, but sanity, I am convinced, is the most precarious of all. It is a simple announcement an 18th century fan maker can offer in her Inquisition. It is the nature of thought, is it not, to come up with ideas. Ricky DuCournay comes up with ideas. She proves that the meeting of imagination and language that occurs in literature can offer access to the mysterious core of experience. As she writes in The Fountains of Neptune, all words share the intrinsically enigmatic character of everything, real, imagined, and dreamed. In Ricky's most recent novel, Gazelle, a girl named Elizabeth is so continually astonished at what she sees in the world that her jaw hangs open. Her father says about her that once at Memphis, a fly flew down her throat. Her father's friend assures her that it is a wonderful thing to be so easily astonished. It means your soul is quick, very quick and nimble. Ricky DuCournay is one of contemporary literature's quickest, nimblest writers, and she makes astonishment contagious. While you read her books, beware of flies, since your mouth will hang open in astonishment. She is our Borges, our Kafka, our Calvino. She brings to American literature the quirkiness of Angela Carter and the mysteries of Isaac Dinesen and the ribald eroticism that is all her own. She is one of the most supple and imaginative writers at work today. She makes us think hard about what we take for granted, and she wakes us up to the wonders of the ordinary world. Now, if you correspond with Ricky, you'll be lucky enough to receive letters filled with her illustrations, because she's also a magnificent artist. And if you're really lucky, you'll have a conversation with her one day, and the next day she'll call you up to tell you that you appeared in her dream. And as she recounts it in mesmerizing detail, you'll forget that it is only a dream. And the next thing you know, you'll be thinking of Ricky's dream as something strange and magical that really happened. And your vision of the world, of yourself in the world, will be transformed, which is the same effect her writing has on readers. She casts a spell illuminating the intrinsically enigmatic character of everything. Please welcome Ricky DuCournay.
Thank you so much. What an extraordinary thing to be in this gorgeous place and to be introduced by the greatest living American writer and to be among old friends. I'm so grateful and delighted. And I wish to dedicate this reading to two wonderful men, my husband, Jonathan Cohen, and Patrick Lannan, marvelous men who are not afraid of smart women. Thank you for your support. This is a brief offering to Patrick Lannan from the book that I'm reading from, The Fanmaker's Inquisition, and then I'll go back to the beginning. But I wanted to offer this first. This is in the voice of the fanmaker. You'll be hearing two voices, the voice of a fanmaker and the voice of her friend, the Marquis de Sade. A book is a private thing, citizen. It belongs to the one who writes it and to the one who reads it. Like the mind itself, a book is a private space. Within that space, anything is possible. The greatest evil and the greatest good. I'm going to begin with the first chapter, at least a good sized chunk of it. As often happens to me. Books appear because a character will appear and seize me by the scruff of the neck, and I have no choice but to go with him or her. And in this case, it was a fan maker, and there she was, wanting my attention, and sent me off to, first of all, my dictionary to learn more about fans, because things were happening so quickly. And then I realized, this is the French Revolution, and then, oh my God, she's a good friend of the Marquis de Sade. I'm going to have to read all Sade. That's I read as much as I could possibly bear. So we open with her. A fan is like the thighs of a woman. It opens and closes. A good fan opens with a flick of the wrist. It produces its own weather, a breeze not so strong as to muss the hair. There is a vocabulary attendant upon fan making. Like a person, the fan has three principal parts. Les brins, or ribs, are most often of wood. Les panaches, or as courtesans call them, the legs, are also made of wood, or ivory, or mother of pearl, and these may also be jade, green, the color of the eye, rose, the color of the flesh, and white, the color of the teeth. The mount, and this is also a sexual term, which is sometimes called la feuille, or the leaf, another sexual term dating, it is said, from the time of Adam. The mount is made of paper, or silk, or swanskin. Swanskin. A fine parchment made from the skin of an unborn lamb, limed, scraped very thin, and smoothed down with pumice and chalk. The mount may be made of taffeta or lace or even feathers, but these are cumbersome. A fan trimmed with down has a tendency to catch to the lips if they are moist or rouged. A paper fan can be a treasure, especially if it is from Japan. The Japanese make the finest paper fans and the most obscene. These are sturdier than one might think. Such a fan is useful when one is bored, forced to sup with an ailing relative whose ivory dentures stink. It is said that the pleated fan is an invention of the Japanese and that the Chinese collapsed in laughter when it was first introduced to China. The prostitutes, however, took to it at once. Why is that? Because it can be folded and tucked up a sleeve when, having lifted one's skirts and legs, one goes about one's business. Soon the gentlemen were sticking theirs down their boots, a gesture of evident sexual significance. Once I saw a fan from India. The panache were carved to look like hooded cobras about to strike the naked beauty who, stretched out across the mount, lay sleeping. That was a beautiful fan. Earlier, you referred to the three parts of the person. Name these. The head, the trunk, and the limbs. Exactly so. Please continue. Little mirrors may be glued to the fan so that one may admire oneself and dazzle others. It may be pierced with windows of mica or studded with gems. A telescopic lens may be attached to the summit of a panache. Such a fan is useful at the theater. The Comtesse Gamblette owns a fan made of a solid piece of silver, cut in the form of a heart and engraved with poetry. Everything is to your taste. You snap up the world with haste. A red fan is a symbol of love, a black one of death, of course. When the fan in question, the one found in the locked chamber at Lacoste, was ordered, what did Sade say exactly? He came to the atelier looking very dapper, and he said, I want to order a pornographic ventilabrum, and he burst out laughing. I said, I understand pornographic, monsieur, but ventilabrum? A flabellum, he cried, laughing even more, with a scene of flagellation. I can paint it on a fan, I said, somewhat out of patience with him, although I have to admit I found him perfectly charming, on velvet or on vellum, and I can do you a vernis martin. This caused him to double over with hilarity. Do me, he cried, do me, you seductive, adorable fan maker, a vernis martin as best as you can and as quickly as you can, and I will be your eternal servant. You do me too much honor, I replied. Then I took down his order and asked for an advance to buy the ivory. Because of the guild regulations, I purchased the skeletons from another craftsman. Sod wanted a swanskin mount set to ivory, which he wanted very fine. Meaning, the ivory of domesticated elephants is brittle because the animals eat too much salt. Wild ivory is denser, far more beautiful, and more expensive, too. For pierced work, it cannot be surpassed. Then the mount needed thin slices of ivory cut into ovals for the faces, les fesses, the breasts. This request was unusual. I have received stranger requests, citizen. Continue. The slivers of ivory, no bigger than a fingernail, give beauty and interest to swanskin and vellumist as mother of pearl. I am sometimes able to procure these decorative elements for a fair price from a maker of buttons and belt buckles because I have an arrangement with him. Describe this arrangement. I paint his buttons. Continue. The making of buckles and buttons is not wasteful. Nonetheless, there is always something left over, no matter the industry. I also use scraps to embellish the panache, not where the fingers hold the fan, because over time, the skin's heat causes even the best paste to soften. But farther up, the pieces hold so fast, no one has ever complained. And this is the paste that was used to fix the 6 wafers to the upper section of the mount. The same, although I diluted it as the wafers were fragile. The entire fan is fragile. So I told Sod. He said it did not matter. The fan was an amusement, a gift for a whore. Some would call it blasphemy, painting licentious acts, including sodomy, on the body of Christ. We are no longer living beneath the boot of the Catholic Church, citizen. I never was a practicing Catholic. Like the paste that holds them to the fan, the wafers are made of flour and water. They are of human manufacture, and nothing can convince me of their sacredness. Your association with a notorious libertine and public enemy is under question today. Personally, I don't give a fig for blasphemy, although I believe there is no place in the revolution for sodomites. But now, before we waste any more time, will you describe for the comité the scenes painted on the fan? The fan, in possession of the Comité de Surveillance de la Commune de Paris, is handed to her. Is this the fan you made for Sod? Of course it is. She examines the fan briefly. It is a convention to paint figures and scenes within cartouche placed against a plain background, or perhaps a background decorated with a discreet pattern of stars or hearts or even eyes, as I have done here. In this case, there are 2 sets of cartouche, the 6 painted wafers well varnished at the top and the 3 large isolated scenes beneath, 3 being the classic number. And now describe for the comité the scenes. There is a spaniel. The girl is naked. The girls are naked, as are the gentlemen, except for the peeping Tom hiding just outside the window. And the spaniel. He is dressed in a little vest, and he carries a whip in his teeth. His master's whip. And the master is in the picture, too? Yes, smack in the middle. It is a portrait of Sod with an enormous erection. As specified in the agreement? Exactly. Have it point to the right, he said, because if I could fuck God right in the eye, I would. And he laughed. Point it right for hell, he said. So I did. The comité is curious to know about your continued service to the Marquis de Sade. I paint pictures for him, and I... What is the nature of these pictures? Why is he wanting pictures? Because he is in prison. He has nothing before his eyes but the guillotine. All day he has nothing to occupy his mind but executions, and all night nothing but his own thoughts. Explosive thoughts. Yes, those are his words. Explosive thoughts. Okay, now we move to Saad's voice. The book is made up of his reveries, but also his letters to the fan maker. Ami, up here in my aerie, I consider the facts. Those 5 days in September when Satan, disguised as a citizen, ruled Paris. And if the bodies of the victims are rotting away in their beds of lime and straw, if the courtyards are washed clean of blood and the gardens weeded of eyes and teeth, if already the world, always so eager to forget, is forgetting, I, Donatien de Sade, remember. I remember how a vinegar maker named Damien cut the throat of a general before cutting out his heart, and how he put it to his lips. Ah, the exemplary Mayan gesture. How a flower girl was eviscerated and the wound made into the hearth that roasted her alive. How a child was told to bite the lips of corpses. How one Mademoiselle de Sombreuil was given a glass of human blood to drink. How the face of the king's valet was burned with torches. How one Monsieur de Montsabre was smoked in his own chimney. How the children incarcerated in Bicêtre were so brutally raped that their corpses were not recognizable. And how the clothes of the victims taken from the corpses were carefully washed, mended, pressed, and put up for sale. The revolution, mamie, shall pay for itself. And I remember, alas, I shall never forget, how my cousin Stanislas, that gentle boy, was thrown from a window the night of August 10th, how his body, broken on the street, was torn apart by the crowd. All night the bells sounded, I hear them even now, the bells of massacre, the bells of rage. What do you expect, Danton, all jowl and black bile, said to the Comte de Ségur? We are dogs, dogs born in the gutter. Already, although blood continues to spill and the trees of Paris are daily watered with tears, there are those who would say, all this never happened, that the trials and executions are orderly, silent, fair, that such stories, the head of Madame de Lamballe exhibited on a pike of Monsieur de Montmorin impaled and carried to the National Assembly for display, are false, the fables so dear to the popular imagination. Well, then, I ask you, if this is so, why am I, whose imagination is clearly as popular as the next man's, why am I still locked away? There are days when horror has me feeling fortunate to be secreted in my tower, unseen, an all-seeing eye remembering, yet seemingly forgotten. When I leave my area at last, spring will have come, perhaps, and the cobbles of the killing yards will have been washed clean by April showers. Sometimes my tomb feels like home. For one thing, I needn't go to the window if I don't want to. I need not listen for the blade, but can instead plug my ears and loudly hum. I can, like a wasp in his nest, high above the world, get myself thoroughly drunk on honey. Which reminds me, I ate all the pastille. I shall lose my teeth. No matter. Like Danton, I don't give a fuck. What will be left to bite into? Without its kings, France will be as unsavory as America. France, too, is to be run by merchants. Merchants, I have met some, a good number, in jail. Their notion of beauty is forgery. Their idea of virtue, counterfeit. Their hearts are in deficit. Their interests simple. Their pricks as dog-eared and limp as old banknotes. Welcome to the new century. We shall tumble into it as frightened rats tumble into a sewer. And the horrors that will be done in the name of prosperity will make all the corrupt castles of my mind look like little more than the idle thoughts of a cloistered priest. My earliest memories are not of hired buffoons, or of riding pig-a-back upon a poor wretch hired for that service, but of Madame de Roussillon dressed in spangles and telling stories in a hushed voice. In one, Gargantua eats a salad of pilgrims, and in another, Gulliver dances a jig for a queen the size of Cheops. Later, after I nearly ripped the prince to shreds, he refused to play horsey unless I played the horse's part. I was sent packing to my uncle's castle keep, where I often slipped away to rustle up some village brats all rough and merry. I was as enchanted as they when, in the cobbler's back room, lit only by a candle, finger shadow figures were made to dance upon the wall. Guignol and highwaymen, a witch on her way to Sabbath, La Fontaine's raven, the cheese tumbling from its beak round as a fist, Jonah swallowed by the whale, Thumbkin, Puss in Boots. Or when Folle Blanche took us into her dark kitchen to feed us apples and omelets and told us her true tales of the infant Jesus, in which the Son of God shared the womb with kings and comets and camels, and who, while still in the cradle, shot all the way to Rome and into the Pope's face. Here's how Folle Blanche made an omelet. She'd sauté her marrows in butter till sizzling, with a splash of oil to keep them from scorching, then whip her eggs till foaming. She'd take a sip of wine. She'd add some chives, chopped very fine, sorrel, perhaps a pinch of thyme. She'd take a sip of wine. Now the eggs are in the pan. She takes a sip of wine. She sets them to shiver and shake to a man. She takes a sip of wine, then roars, "Come, boys, let's sup, it's time." She takes a sip of wine and sprinkles the eggs with salt. The poor know nothing of pepper. And if we eat with our fingers, we feast like kings of Spain. The Romans made their omelets with honey. If a savory omelet stuffed with lobster or ham, or both, is what I'd sell my soul for this minute if I had one, don't think I'd scorn the Roman sort, or the jam omelets of my youth, as delicate as the thoughts of an angel, amply dusted with confectioner's sugar and disgorging strawberry jam. You'd think, wouldn't you, they'd serve eggs in prison, a wholesome, inexpensive food, and if your sense is in your cranium and not in your navel, easy to prepare, although perhaps beyond the skill of prison cooks who cannot boil noodles to save their lives. If I had a say in this, I'd assure each prison a poultry yard and, come to think of it, a trout pond, a vegetable garden, an orchard, a milk cow. Better still, I'd supply each prisoner with his own hen. She would afford companionship, keep the cell free of vermin, and provide those precious eggs, which, as every country bumpkin knows, are at their best within the hour of being laid, especially if they are to be soft-boiled. When the tedium of confinement proved too much to bear, the prisoner might blow out his eggs, just as the Russians do, and decorate them. The more I think about it, the more I like this idea. And a truly well-behaved prisoner, although he might persist in thinking the sorts of thoughts that got him into trouble in the first place, might be rewarded, for his manners at least, with a gift of a goose. If he was given a potted fruit tree, the fowl could perch there. Its dung, falling as gravity dictates, would fertilize the tree, producing fruit of great quality. But for all this to be possible, a certain demand must be met. A large window, facing south, allowing the sun to enter and invigorate the living things inside, the cell, bird, tree, and man. One of Sade's reveries in his cell. The first thing I do is give Paris back her ornaments, that is to say her signs, which were outlawed 30 years ago by that prick Sartine. He resented their size, unbridled paganism, ribaldry, and subversive humor, for there were caricatures of the clergy, wonderfully cruel, and pictures of kings being buggered by bankers. Paris, said Sartine, chokes on obscenity. It is true that the signs had proliferated to a dizzying degree, and they had succumbed to gigantism. It seemed the domestic articles of Brobdignag were hanging everywhere. This proliferation was extreme, and yet in those riotous streets I remember so well, streets in which one needed to duck one's head constantly, else be brained by brass roosters, one walked turn by turn, entranced, instructed, and amused, intoxicated. In those days, one read Paris like a book. Imagine Diderot's encyclopedia thus, universally intelligible.
an entire education was there, or closer to the truth, potentially so. In other words, I like to imagine my Paris hung not only with poor cocks and wheels of cheese, but, and why not, with the lost phallus of Osiris, the sacred cats of Egypt, Apis and the gemmed bees of Childeric. Here, Perseus holds the Medusa by her hissing hair. There, Diana, buttocks alert, stands beside the plumed serpent of the Mexicas. Above, St. Francis's tongue, and farther down the street, the Holy Mother's immaculate cunt. Speaking of Isis, I give Paris back to her. By hanging her image not only above every corset shop and dairy, but in the shadow of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, I build her a temple just as it was a few centuries ago, and as it had been since the devil knows when. Black Isis, Queen of Egypt, I give Paris back to you. But wait, I'm not quite finished hanging signs. If my city is to be instructive, it needs minerals and maps, examples of geological turbulences, body parts, botanical models, bestiaries, and more. Throughout the city, accumulations of disparate things wired together and designating the public wonder rooms, where a multiplicity of possible orderings of nature would teach rational thought and thus skepticism. Having imagined the signs, the inns, le Con d'Or, la Bite d'Argent, le Cure Royal, la Mandragore, the gardens, the garden of helpless love, of jealous love, of illicit love, of impossible pleasures, of memory, of ideal encounters, of pandemonium and of promise, the whores, Seminal, Bulimia, Pomona, Feline, Sucette, I next imagine a calendar of days, a day devoted to memory, an entire month devoted to the study of dreams, a festival in honor of the prostate, of seminal fluid, of the orgasm, the opening of an academy devoted to the erogenous zones, erogenous zones. I can't blame that on the pollen. A day to honor the dog star, the solstices, a month to honor astronomy and all the planetary and stellar phenomenon. A surgeon's day, a day to honor pastry chefs with prizes given to those most adept in the manufacture of puff pastry. A day devoted to the public mourning of life's errors. An entire year given over to the study of primary causes. A day devoted to international forums on masturbation. A day taken up with the fabrication of grimoire of chocolate. A month to honor architecture, vanilla, and the coffee bean. A day in which everyone will wear a Persian bonnet and make beer. A day to honor mollusks and polenta. An entire year devoted to roses. Another to lilies, another to irises, another to the phallus, the cunt, and gingerbread. An entire century to celebrate the death of God. An entire century to condemn bad faith, the notion of God's grace, the guillotine, the pillory, the hangman's noose, and English cookery. A decade devoted to perfume. Saturdays turned over to the painting and repair of all buildings, public and private. Everyone in work clothes, damsels with brooms, lots of fucking in municipal rooms, and in the evening, bonfires, pig roasts, carnival comedies. Sundays, a public scrubbing. All assholes good as new. Free dental work. And lessons in the morality of amorous strategy, the precepts of an enlightened atheism, the erotic arts, and philosophical inquiry. Free theater, bouquets of seasonal flowers, and novels offered all around. Cannons melted down into goblets, water pipes, cowbells, midnight balls, and in the Maya manner, barbecues. Monday through Friday, days officiated by a Papa Fatuatum, a Pope of Fools, to be elected each week. All this as just another way of spitting in the eye of Saint-Just, who would have everyone a farmer, a soldier, or a worker. No fancies, no delights, no women, no fucking, no buggery, no sauces, candy, theater, books, just dull-witted eunuchs all dressed in canvas and horsehair and made to sleep like cattle on the floor. In my Paris, everyone has a bed, a big, beautiful bed with curtains of calico, summer and velvet, winter, and sheets as white as cream.
these beds to be the sanctuaries of erotic experiment, clarity, and amorous confusion. In my Paris, drôle and drôlesse, guys and dolls, are so disguised as to have abandoned their particular humanity for a unique transparency of being. In other words, they are so visible in their disguises that they can no longer be seen. They bounce off the eye as a rubber ball bounces off the playing field. Wherever they walk, the city is a stage, a constant parade of true invention. Fashion is the epitome of chaos. On stilts and slippers of green glass and pewter suits and wigs of lilies, I dress my Paris in the hues not of convention, but of my own invention. Fresh pepage green, a deep violet called Neptune's balls, rose the color of the palms of a Nigerian princess, a brassy gold called Giglio Romano. There are two rules only, and they are, one, all ecclesiastical categories must be resolutely pagan or satirical. Two, nothing will ever recur. High priests of astonishment, masters and mistresses of masturbatory madness, the hierophants of the sexual heart, the earls of ejaculation, all roll into town on Thursdays in shoes fitted out with wheels. They are dressed in the manner of Mozabites. They wear masks of silk and silk veils. Only their sex, always prodigious, is visible. Their task is to animate and imagine the public peep shows, wherein one may see a naked Perseus sporting a stony phallus and approaching the Gorgon with horror and admiration, or simply watch a maiden sweetly sleeping, a flight of geese. Now there's a thing of such sumptuous banality it makes me weep just to think of it. A cat licking her paws, a fishwife fucking an eel, a child eating a waffle, a field of wild lilies, a forest stream, a meadow brook, the sky, the sea. This is what dreaming my Paris has taught me, that an infinite number of cities are possible, that our revolution could have moved bloodlessly with imagination and grace, that instead of burning, my Paris might have blossomed. Thank you so much. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
So Ricky has just read a book from a book about Inquisitions. And here we sit.
So tell me.
Lucky us.
Okay.
What did you really mean by fucking in the municipal rooms? No, I'm not going to ask that question.
Instead, I have a very serious question here.
In fact, believe it or not, Ricky and I did not talk about this, did not plan this, but you began with what I was going to begin with.
Oh, really?
Because you began with the line, and I'm going to read it back. The fan maker says about reading, a book is a private space. Within that space, anything is possible, the greatest evil and the greatest good. And so I wanted to go from there and ask, let's talk about this private space that you create, that the reader shares. And I'm interested in how expression becomes communication. Basically, I want to pick your brain and figure out how you do it. How can you be so brilliant? But I'll try to approach it that way. What happens as you are building that space? I can ask you, how much are you thinking about the dialogue with the reader? How do you communicate as you are expressing? Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. The problem is it's a very mysterious process, because I really do, one could say a number of things, but I really do search for a kind of state of grace, even though it may be a terrifying place, but that is to say the place where characters do search forth. I mean, if you're a novelist,
it's not going to be your book. You know, it's going to reveal itself to you as you're writing it. It's going to be your character's book. And one counts on their voices. And so I teach in this sort of, I think, somewhat eccentric way because, you know, there's sort of no way around this, I think. One needs to be in this place of utter safety within oneself, as dangerous and fraught as writing always is, because inevitably, if you're going to write well, you're going to have to confront your own terrors and complications and knots. And so I feel, one, that this is a voyage of self-discovery, first of all. This is a voyage in which I'm visiting a place that is unmapped. I've never been here before. If I knew where I was going, well, I don't think I'd really want to bother to go there again. And so I give myself permission to travel as far as I could. And it is traveling blind. But then these characters do appear, as the fan maker appeared. And then later on, Saad, with these powerful voices and kinds of rhythms. And they direct the momentum. And so my concern really is to find a kind of intuitive truth there, you know, to do them justice as best I can, to do their periods justice as best I can, to work within the interstices of history, so that I've done a great deal of research. I'm creating a world, I'm inventing a world, and yet it is rooted in the real, so that it will hold. And then in the long run, first of all, I want to write a book that I want to read. I'm the first reader. And the magic is, I mean, the extraordinary surprise really is that you do that. I mean, you write the book that you long to read, and there'll be other people, you know, and there may not be many of them, but that, you know, that isn't really my concern. You know, it's an extraordinary thing to share this experience with another reader or other readers. But it is a process always of revelation. And so in a way, I'm the first surprised. I mean, I really thought, oh my God, this, I have to deal with the French Revolution now. This, you know, a trip to the library, 150 books around my workspace, and one of them, Saad's 100 Years of Sodom, which he couldn't even read himself because it's so dreadful. It's such an impossibly dark and difficult book to read. But it was demanded of me. I had no choice.
That you might have seen in the paper today an article about how the mayor of a suburb of Mexico City is requiring all the policemen and on his force to read a book a month.
What do you think of
that? No, I'm reminded by, you know, how many readers? Well, there are a few more, suddenly. Writing about this, writing about a fan maker, writing from a dog's point of view, writing from a man's point of view, writing from another point in history, you're crossing boundaries. Are there boundaries? What happens when you cross a boundary? How do you cross that boundary? And are there boundaries that we can't cross? Is there anything that's prohibited? That you write so much about transgression. In writing and talking about your own writing, you talk about revealing and unearthing dogmatic truths and showing the lies of language. So I'm kind of interested in how far can it go, the imaginative effort of language.
Perhaps it's endless, you know. I mean, it seems to me that's the extraordinary thing about writing a book, that it is a place for thinking well, deeply. I mean, you see your thoughts on the page, and you can go back over and over again and carry those ideas further. But I also feel that this is a kind of sacred place for a writer. Anything should be possible. One should be able to go anywhere. The trick is that one needs to go there responsibly.
And what is that? I mean, that's part of this voyage, I think, finding out both, and it becomes a certain intuition, I think, knowing when perhaps you're skirting an issue, knowing when you're being a coward, knowing when you need to push further, knowing when you're confronting a very, very difficult issue and have to be up for it. One of the reasons I loved writing this particular book, The Fan Maker, was that I did have this outrageous character who gave me an enormous amount of room and who was constantly presenting problems, problems of morality, of moral vision. And one of the things that intrigued me so much about de Sade, because de Sade pushed things really as far as one can go, that he wrote about sexual murder. He wrote about sexual murder as no one ever has or probably ever can. I mean, I can't imagine going further, though perhaps one can go further. And yet he was at one point freed by the revolution, released from jail, and he became a judge, and they put him back in jail because he was against the guillotine, couldn't bear the idea of capital punishment. And that fascinated me, and that gave me room, and it also really revealed to me perhaps the true nature of this book, which was that it is fair and safe within one's mind or one's book to imagine anything at all. That is one thing. To act upon these very dark dreams is another. And so in the book, I compare him to an inquisitor, Bishop Landa, who was responsible for the destruction of the Maya, much of the Maya culture. It's extraordinary how the Maya managed to persist despite all of this, and the burning of their books, so that there are only 3.5 books remaining from the vast libraries of the Maya. So there are the two monsters who can confront themselves in this book. Mm-hmm. But I always say to my students, you know, work responsibly, but imaginatively, and go as far as you can go, and disrupt all dogmatisms, whether they be social, political, or neurotic. And by neurotic, I mean to disrupt those sort of givens that you have received probably in childhood about your very nature, perhaps your innate badness, or that you cannot go there, or you cannot speak about this, or you have seen nothing, or this is a story you cannot tell. Well, no, you have, you know, this is your gift to yourself. This is your space to investigate everything and to go as far as you dare go. And fearlessness is a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a moment when in Phosphor in Dreamland, Phosphor's first word, he looks at the sun and says, why? And that seemed to me an essential word in your work. It kind of animates the interrogations. Why this? Why did that happen? Why do we think this? Why do we make the mistakes we do? And thinking, too, about this child who, or the words, the stories that first come to children, you write a lot about children, about childish imagination, about play. And there's one particular image you describe of walking in, I think it's in an essay, walking into an elevator in Cairo that was all mirrors mm-hmm. around you, and being so startled by that as a child, by the, as you said, finite movement of the elevator going up and down, the vertical movement, but then this endlessness of, as you looked into the mirrors, it seemed to never stop horizontally. And that just made me think about your the children in your work, or the importance of that kind of freshness of vision, I suppose. And I guess I wanted to ask about that. What can we learn from a child, from the child's imagination, from the child's fresh new appropriation of language?
Well, that's very much where I want to be when I'm writing, and very much where I want to, I guess, ultimately bring people who are reading, is that those moments of those powers, those potencies, those moments when the world incandesces. When I was a very small child, it was one of my first memories. I had an ABC book, and I was probably 3 or 4, and it was a large book with full color pictures, and B had the image of a bee with a very distinct stinger, and I And I opened the book one day, and I felt that my whole body had been stung. And that was sort of an amazing moment for me. And then years later, when I was about 8 years old, I was in the woods with a friend of mine, and we heard some buzzing, and we came upon the corpse of a red fox, and it had been shot, and its belly had exploded, and it was swarming with bees. And it was a terrifying vision, but it was also very gorgeous, because the fox was gorgeous. And I don't remember any stench, which is interesting. And so there was this red fur and the yellow bees. And the day ignited. And there are moments like that that I look for, both as I'm preparing to write, but then as I'm writing, I'd like the world to incandesce somehow. And recently, I was reading the Sufi, suddenly his name escapes me. I'm sorry. But 13th century Sufi master, Ibn Arabi. And he talks about the Quran coming directly, I mean, this is the divine book, an emanation from the divine directly. And in Arabic, there are these diamonds. You know, Arabic is such a beautiful script, and there are these diamonds incorporated in the script. And those diamonds are actually, they're sparks that ignite the text. They're there to give the text back its initial fire. And also, as you're singing the text aloud, those are the moments where you pause for breath. So it's both fire and breath. And I love that. It seemed to me this is sort of what the writer wants to do, and as a reader, what one wants to receive is a text that is sort of pulsing with life, pulsing with breath, and incandescent.
Mm-hmm. It takes a special sensibility to see that carcass in the woods covered with bees and say, wow, that's beautiful. But that is important. I mean, to be able to see things in a new way. That, you know, I read your work and I go in and I see things in a new way. One of the things I see is that the world is a very funny place, and I keep forgetting that. And partly it's something children can teach us. Although I'm reminded of a dear friend of the family when he was six, and I was trying to organize this game of charades. He said, "This is the most unfun game in the whole stinking world." And I thought, that's what I always do. You know, I make these unfun games in this stinking world. So I thought, I'd like to know how, you know, where does humor begin? Hey, you're writing along, and suddenly, you know, there's, she takes a sip of wine. And you go along, and she takes a sip of wine. So I'd like to hear you talk about that. How do you make it a fun instead of an unfun?
Okay. Well, I think that's part of the process of subversion. You know, if you're interested in subverting givens of all kinds, it's like going back to the emperor's clothes. You know, it's that subversion of authority. You realize, there he is with nothing on at all. And I think, you know, dogmatists are terrifying, but they are also funny because they're always working within fixed systems. And I find that again and again, I do write about tyrants of various kinds, interested in tyrants, interested in that mind, I think, because it does worry me so much. You know, what makes people into bullies? What makes people so afraid of the imagination? And it's not, you know, sort of not only tyrants out there, but I find even this comes even from writers. You begin to question that somehow. That releases a sort of comic impulse, I think. But some of it too is rhythm, and I suppose that there's so much hard work involved in writing. You know, and it's, I know stand-up comics go over their routines again and again, and I remember working on my first novel, and I had just had an experience that was very funny. I was living in France in a small little house in the country, and the brother, older brother of one of my son's friends came to the door with a mysterious box, and wanted to come in and show me. And he was selling pots and pans, and he set the box down and he opened it, and then he set out this velvet blanket or velvet tablecloth. And he said, I'm going to show you pots unlike any you've ever seen before. These are beautiful and they'll last forever. And I think they were called, you know, eternity or something. And the amazing thing is that you put just a little bit, you put water in there and you put your vegetables there and you close it and show me, get me some water, I'll show you. And the water never can come out, so you're steaming things, it's incredibly healthy and so on. Get me some water. So I got him some water and he poured it in the pot and he put the cover on and he turned it upside down and all this water spilled all over him.
What?
And it was a wonderfully funny, and of course he lost the sale. But I wanted to include that as a chapter in the book, and it turns out he's not selling pots in my book, but this character comes in to sell knives. The knives will be used in a dastardly fashion later on. But I remember going over the rhythms again and again and again, revising that damn chapter, you know, a dozen times because the rhythms were not quite right. And at some point, I found myself laughing, and people make such fun of writers doing this, you know, sobbing and laughing as they... There were. It was one of the few delights. Every once in a while.
Just again. I thought it was the cat.
Huh. So, yeah, I mean, it is also a very mysterious process. I mean, why is rhythm so important? Why, mm-hmm. you know, does that sort of suddenly kick something off? Certain repetitions, sounds of words.
Well, how do you decide what form anything's going to take? Because Ricky paints, she writes poetry, she writes stories of an infinite variety of shapes. You know, a page or 30 pages. And how do you decide as you know, when the apparition of this character, this voice, introduces itself to you, and then you, how do you decide what form that takes?
Now, it's sort of embarrassing because I'm very much a rational creature. However, when I'm writing, it really is so much about intuition and a kind of sense of things, so that there are stories that need a page, and there are other times when I'll begin something and I'll just sort of know, oh, okay, this is going to be, you know, this is going to take 3 years, you know, or this is going to take 18 months. And I'm not quite sure why. I mean, it really is as though there is a kind of vision and the form often reveals itself very quickly. But I usually don't know very much at the offset. I know, for example, you know, one book presented itself, and very quickly, within two chapters, I knew, okay, there will be two voices, and it'll be a kind of Manichaean back and forth, a voice of good and evil, though there'll be some ambiguities. But basically, we'll move back and forth between those two poles. And then I realized, okay, it's also going to be a book about fire. So fires of sexual desire, fires of intellectual curiosity, the fires of rage, the burning of the Amazon, the Holocaust. And that's all I knew, and I knew that pretty early. Or a book that was defined by water. And the only idea I had in terms of structure was there'll be many waters. There'll be swift water and deep water and cold water. There'll be precipitation, there'll be fog. But I know very little, in fact. And I know there are writers who will not begin unless they've got it all mapped out, and I could not work that way. I would find it very hard. But I mean, there's no one way. You know, there are infinite ways to do this. So that when I'm teaching writing, I find my tendency, and I'll say this to the people I'm working with: this is not the only way. You know, I'm giving you just sort of the way I know, and that is a way that does engage the subconscious mind as fearlessly as one can engage it and trust it. Trust that this is your mind, you know, and it's a mind that you can engage knowledgeably, and that you'll come to know better and better, and that you'll become more and more familiar with it, and it will become less terrifying, and you can always travel further the more you work with it. But that's sort of where I come from as a writer.
Well, it was in the Fountains of Neptune, I guess, what you were referring to. The character Nicholas goes around a bazaar gathering toys, and there's little toy monkeys and then other things like scissors and paper and glue, so he can transform them. And he says to himself, I thought of him as this kind of manic artist right then, and it's a wonderful novel and a wonderful scene. And when he's gathering the material, he recites to himself, order and system are necessary in everything. But we know that that's not necessarily true if we're reading Ricky Ducournay. And then in an essay in the Monstrous and Marvelous, you write, moral and existential dilemmas are not solved and are often aggravated by gathering and classifying. So there's an interesting, you know, division there. And I'm wondering, to ask kind of existential question, what role does order and system play in the creative process? Yeah, how do you, this world that is so monstrous, so chaotic, that appears to us, the managing, I mean, in a way you were starting to talk about that, the managing the subconscious, but how, to what extent are you rationally applying order to this chaos?
I find myself going back over and over again. You know, there's this initial impulse, and ultimately I think every page I write is probably revisited a dozen times. So part of it is, okay, this is Sod's voice. Is it consistent? Mm-hmm. Is this the vocabulary that he would use? You know, and I go to my Oxford English Dictionary and I check, when was this word available to us? Or what are the words in English that come from French that I can use that were available during his time? So that's a part of the ordering, or a vocabulary that will suit also the weather, the kind of mood that I'm looking for. So the in a way, the vision calls upon structure and organization and clarity. I'm always cutting back as well, getting rid of extraneous stuff. I don't want, especially having a Baroque imagination. I think I write very classically, in fact. I'm really interested in a very pure, clean sentence. Mm-hmm. And things like, I mean, all writers do this, you know, if I reverse the sentence and end with this particular word, everything will shift. Mm-hmm. I started off as a poet, and so, used to organizing language in a very tight way. And I do that with fiction. I mean, mm-hmm. as you do. I mean, mm-hmm. my God, mm-hmm. consummate stylist. Yeah, right. It takes an enormous amount of work.
We're talking about you. I wonder if this is relevant. In an essay on Octavio Paz, you talk about the delights of what you call magical ambiguity. It's a wonderful mm-hmm. phrase. And then at another point, it was in The Deep Sea that you sent me recently, you talk about the dangers of magical thinking.
Oh, yes.
So there's a difference
between
magical, this idea of magical ambiguity, which involves mystery, and magical thinking, which seems to be one of the dangers that you are going after in your work.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to be ruled by magical thinking. And there's a paradox there. You know, Calvino says poetry is the enemy of chance, and then he says poetry is the daughter of chance, and it's a similar kind of thing. I mean, it seems to me that magical thinking is where all our thinking comes from, and it's a poetic thinking. I mean, for example, an Egyptian of 3,000 years ago picking up a shell in the desert, not having a notion where this comes from, and there's something magical there. And so there's this connection with the moon. The moon vanishes every evening, and the idea was it went into the sea. So clearly this comes from the moon somehow. So that must mean that the moon drops the shell when it rises, and the moon is also a cow because it has horns, and so on. So that's gorgeous, and that's magical thinking, and it leads to poetry, and ultimately it leads to science too, because you're curious about the world. One is curious in investigating the world, and over time begins to discover that, well, no, indeed, there is no cow up in the sky, and this is the shell I'm holding is a fossil, and so on. But magical thinking is also, I mean, it also could be profoundly neurotic thinking or even psychotic thinking, that you're guilt-ridden, for example, and so you see, you're driving along and you see a red light and you think, oh, that's because I'm thinking bad thoughts, sexual thoughts. That's magical thinking and very destructive, and you don't, and you're mad if you think that way. And so you're driven, in fact, by your madness. Whereas if you're a writer and you're dealing with magical thinking, in this other way, this poetic way, it opens the world up in an unexpected manner. I mean, it takes you to new places. You're making connections that are strange and wonderful, and they renew the world. But one doesn't want to be ruled by that. I mean, you don't want to go to the grocery store, you know, sort of led by the nose by magical thinking. And in that essay, you talk about, I make the difference between the early collector's cabinets, which were wonderful, you know, the 18th, 17th century cabinets, when things were coming in from the New World, and people would collect, I don't know, a stool from Alaska and a shell from Thailand and a fossil from West Africa and all sorts of curiosities and bottles and so on, and put them together, and they would have no, they would be a kind of magical mess of things. They would be powerful and interesting, but meaningless altogether. And then comes along the Museum of Natural History, you know, the 19th century, in this great time of, or 18th century already, ordering of the natural world, where you begin to make connections. Well, something else is happening there, and both of these fascinate me, you know. But I am interested in ordering the world and ordering the chaos of the imagination in some way, and being responsible as I'm writing, you know, because I really do believe in a moral vision. I mean, I do think that we're lacking a moral vision, and this is what is destroying us. You know, I read recently that in 40 years, one-third of all living species will have vanished. One-third of all living species will have vanished in 40 years. This is a deplorable, lethal lack of imagination, a mortal lack of imagination, that we have not, you know, been conscious, aware, delighted in protective of our universe. An extraordinary lack of imagination. And we're going to pay for it. And it's leading to chaos, this lack of imagination. So the idea is somehow that on one hand we have rationality and the other side we have the imagination. I don't believe so. I think both inform one another constantly.
Mm-hmm. It was a very poignant moment, and I heard it in the audience response when de Sade, this crazy mad thinker, says, I'm dreaming my Paris. And if it happened this way, if it was only this way, then this revolution could have happened, mm-hmm. peace could have occurred without the violence.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we think, what could have happened if we had imagine a little bit more imagination, if we thought a little bit harder? The implications, and this is the way the grand project of fiction, the implications of writing about the Inquisition, very relevant today, and you make them, the resonance is delicate but fierce at the same time in that book, and all the work, the moral implications of it is very powerful. I probably should wind down, and I have an extremely important question
Ooh.
To ask, and that's, where'd you get that necklace in those earrings?
Oh! It's always about fashion.
It is.
Oh, this is, my husband gave this to me, and it's Museum of Modern Art, and it's a copy of a Tuareg necklace. Isn't
wow.
it neat?
Wow.
And these are Navajo.
Wow.
Which I bought in
Reading
Boston.
Of Cultures, yeah.
Museum of Natural History. No, it's no Modern Art. Which one? Metropolitan.
Well, thank you very much, Ricky, and
thank you
to the...
Thank you.
Planet.
Thank you, madam. I love you.
Oh, you're wonderful.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.